sometime next week, hopefully. So just wanted to let folks know that today really the focus needs to be on listening. And we pulled everybody together to do a joint hearing so that we don't need to put folks through multiple hearings of going over some really difficult stuff. So I hope that you have, as my kids, teachers would say, you have your listening ears on, and just happy we could bring everybody together. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my co-chair.
Thank you so much, Chair Becker Finn, and welcome to everyone here. This is a really important topic and an important day. So to confirm, the plan today is that we're going to hear the bill presentation and testimony on House File 1071. This is an informational hearing only because it's a joint hearing of the two committees. The bill's in the possession of children and families, and as Chair Becker Finn said, our committee has jurisdiction. We will hear, we'll have a discussion on the bill and the amendments and a vote on Thursday is what is the plan for children and families. Thank you. And then we'll plan is then move it on to the judiciary. So I think Chair Becker Finn's heading up to the testifier table, and I'll invite Vice Chair Keeler and Representative Kozlowski up there as well. And as they settle in, again, I'll just note that we have a number of very honored guests we're going to be hearing from. A number of honored guests we may not be hearing from, but really, really glad to have folks assembled on this very important topic. And I would say, so the bill is not, there's not a formal motion for this hearing, but rather we're simply going to be, as I say, hearing the bill presentation and testimony. And so I would say that Vice Chair Keeler, I think you're the one leading us, and you can start as you're ready, or if Chair Becker Finn or Representative Kozlowski are going, either way.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. I want to pause for a minute. The conversation that we're about to enter in is something that is extremely important to many of us. On really personal levels, it is for me, but also to my community, to the generations before me and the generations after me. Today is a conversation that I wish we would never have to have at a state level, because the reason that we're putting it on the state level is because our Supreme Court is challenging ICWA. ICWA is our Indian Child Welfare Act, which was designed to protect our children in a cultural capacity. I want us to just pause for a minute, because I want us to walk through a moment in what most of us probably experience. So I'm going to kind of share that kindergarten moment that a lot of us have. I don't know many of you in your parent capacity. I'm a mom. And I can remember really clearly when I took my first son to kindergarten, and maybe some of you had the same moment. I sat in the car for 20 minutes and cried hysterically because I was sending my kindergartner to a school, and I knew where they were going to go. I knew who his teacher was. I knew what building he was going to go to. I knew that somebody would call me if something happened to him, and I knew I was going to be able to pick him up at the end of the day, and it was still extremely emotional for me. So I want you to think of like the 3, 4, 5, 6-year-olds in your life, and think about what they're doing. I mean, I have a 6-year-old, and he is jumping all over the couch most of the time, but he's still just lovingly being a child. So I want you to picture those kids in that time frame. And then I want you to think about what happens when individuals who don't look like them, who don't speak their language, come in and quite frankly just take our children. If you think about what that would do to you as a parent, to you as a grandparent, to you as an auntie, to you as anybody who has kids in your life. And what we believe as Indigenous people is that it's important that our kids see individuals who look like them, that the language that we speak so dearly is spoken in their home, that our hair that we believe is grown to be a relationship with the Creator is still allowed to be long. So what this bill does is really just protecting some of those components that we as Indigenous people really believe is good for our kids. What I hope is that we enter into this space with an open heart and an open mind, that Minnesota has an opportunity to come together. We sit on 100% ceded treaty territory with 11 sovereign nations, that today I hope what we can do is be here together and understand that we have an opportunity to protect children who need somebody else to look out for them. I'm not going to take up any more of your time because if you can't tell, this is extremely emotional to me. We are doing this as the legislative, as the Native American Legislative Caucus, because we believe that it is not just me as the lead author in this, that this is really all of our work collectively, and why we chose to come to this space is for moments like this. We are going to take just a couple minutes, and then we're going to share the rest of our time with our testifiers and individuals in our communities who are leaders and who work in this area of work significantly. We will be doing some follow-up for the votes and the things that we do as legislators. But if we can please just enter in this time, like I said, with an open heart and an open mind to protect children who really just need us to protect them the most.
Chair Becker, Representative Kozlowski, or Chair Becker Finn, you want to make Representative Kozlowski?
Thank you, Chair Pinto and members. Buju, Bizandawye, Uzawa, Anaquad, Alicia Kozlowski, Jaga Mashimo, McGizin and Dodem, Gechi Onagaming, Misabikong and Dunjaba. I'm here today as a really proud person, as a Native person, carrying in, as Representative Keeler said, the histories and the contemporary impacts of what it means to be a Native person. And I was asked to share a bit about the context of why MIFLA, why this bill and the urgency and how we got here. And I just want to start by saying that amidst the context and the backdrop of this colonization, that look around and feel this room, that we're the people of the Heartway. We are love, we are medicine, and that we are here with that love and that medicine for our families as culture bearers and keeper of our futures. So throughout history, the United States and Minnesota have carried out intentional and horrific methods of removal and disconnection from our Native children, from their families, their culture, dispossessed of our lands, and disconnection from tribes. Beginning with the federal policy of assimilation in 1819 through the passage of the Indian Civilization Act Fund that encouraged both Protestant and Catholic organizations to provide education for Native Americans that stimulate the civilization process. This led to the creation of boarding schools. And by 1879, the forcible removal of our children from their homes for placement in these government-sponsored residential schools began an attempt to kill the Indian and save the child. Though we don't know just how many children were taken, we know that by 1900, there were at least 20,000 children in boarding schools, and within 25 years, that number had tripled. When the boarding schools began to die out, a new effort began to disconnect our families. From 1958 to 1967, the federal government then enacted a program called the Indian Adoption Project with the goal of white Americans adopting Native children to allow them a better life. Testimony in support of the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act proved that approximately 1 in 4 Native children are placed out of home or in foster care nationally. That rate here in Minnesota is as high as 35%. A report from the 2020 Minnesota DHS indicates that American Indian children are 16.4% more likely than white children to be placed out of home. And many of these children have been lost to their families, to tribes, to adoption, to non-Native families, with those impacts reverberating as we seek to build our kinships and cultural lifeways. And yet again, another series of policies in the 50s furthered the boarding school's damage, echoing policies of assimilation. This is known to us as the termination era that included seizure of tribal land, termination of tribes, and further suppressive policies. So in response to that crisis and recognition of the unique political status of tribes, that's when the United States Congress passed the Indian Child Welfare Act in 1978. In 1985 is when Minnesota led the nation by enacting the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act to supplement ICWA and bolster protections against child removal from families. It was amended in 2015, and since 2018, our tribal leaders have been intent on strengthening ICWA, but is much more urgent now with ICWA under threat. So the bipartisan legislation before you today incorporates the gold standard, bolstering existing protections into Minnesota statutes. And the passage of this bill will continue to effectively work to protect our families, reduce litigation, and provide more clarity so that tribes, counties, government agencies can work under the same expectations and rights and responsibilities. So this bill will codify the Indian Child Welfare Act into state law and reinforce our state's recognition of the stability, security, and sovereignty of our tribal nations and communities in Minnesota. Miigwech.
Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. Chair Becker Finn.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Nijiwanakwadekwe, Makwan and Dodem, Leech Lake, Nindunjaba. So the one thing I do, you know, as the lawyer at this table that I wanted to highlight is that, and Representative Kozlowski touched on this, but part of why this is so important and part of why the previous policies had the impact that they did is that our identity as Native people is not just a cultural identity, it's also a legal identity that stems from the sovereignty of the tribal nations from which we come from. And that is actually, as hopefully folks are aware, we haven't had a sovereignty day yet this year, but that treaties are the supreme law of the land. They actually supersede state law. And that's a political existence. That's a legal existence that is different. So even though we may work in community and together with, you know, as we talk about even the Posse Caucus or BIPOC communities with other communities of color, it is unique as Indigenous people that our existence is also a political existence as the descendants and members of tribal nations. And finally, too, I want to, in recognition, especially for the folks here to testify, that today is also a big day for our community and that it is our Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Day of Remembrance. So today is also a big day for many of us. In that way, there are events in our community that lift up that issue. And finally, we'll just to tie those things together. Folks may not make that connection, but some of the reasons, some of the things that our communities, all of the things that our communities struggle with now are the result of government policies that separated us from our children. That, you know, I, as a parent, when I think of the thing that I would die for, it would be for my children. And I think that's true of most of us as parents, as the gravity of what we're talking about today. So just if we can keep that in mind, that this is a real thing that happened to our communities, that happened even to our direct relatives. My grandmother was a boarding school survivor. And I don't know a Native person who hasn't been directly impacted both personally and at a larger legal level by these government policies. And so this is a way that we can protect our communities moving forward. And that's what we bring to the table today. So thank you, Chair Pinto. And with that, we do want to make sure there's lots of time. There's a lot of people who want to testify today.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, and to the other bill authors. I want to note that there was a miscommunication regarding the location of the meeting, and so that's why we've had a few members that have come in a little bit later because they were directed to the wrong location, and so glad to have everybody here. And then especially glad to be joined by a number of our elected leaders of our sovereign tribal nations, and I'm going to invite them to speak first, of course. Chairman Farron Jackson is the first of those elected leaders, and again, really honored. And so if Chairman Jackson can make his way to the front and there's a series of the elected leaders listed on our agenda. We'll be hearing from each of them. Chairman Jackson, honored to have you with us, sir, and if you can identify yourself once you're settled in and then proceed with your testimony. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Bujou. Bujou, Farron Jackson, Sr., in Indigenous cause, Giwaydin in Digu, Makwanendun dem, Gaza Gaswa Jimmy Cognendun Jaba. Bujou, my relatives and friends, happy Valentine's Day today. I was here last week, too, to testify, and there was some very powerful words that were spoken by everybody that participated in the meeting, and it does get pretty emotional because it's a sensitive subject here when we talk about our families and children's, and we all have them, you know, and our family was affected with out of home placement too before the 1978 Iqbal federal Indian law was established. But it's very hard and emotional to talk about something that is kind of so painful, you know, but I know it, the purpose behind it is to educate everybody so we understand everyone's perspective. It kind of reminds me of like a combat veteran talking about his horrors in the war. You know, there sometimes it's things you actually try to forget or you try to put in the past, but, you know, it always kind of resurfaced itself. But so I'm just, me and my wife came down last night to be a part of this meeting and to kind of share, you know, our feelings and, you know, our reasoning why we support MIFPA in the Iqbal law. You know, we've been very fortunate, me and my wife, Laurel, You know, we've been foster parents for over 30 years. Through this process, we adopted five children into our own home as our own family members, and we still have them today. And 50, 60 kids came through our home in the course of them 30 years, you know, and we still see them. They've grown up, you know. A lot of them are successful today, you know. We adopted a daughter in 2000, and she's 23 years old, and she just recently graduated from college. And she has a four-year-old daughter now, and she's really doing really well, and we're really proud of her. And she's living a sober life today, you know, and she works hard. You know, you know, when kids are removed from homes, you know, even in foster homes, when you have kids, you know, in your homes for some years, and when kids are removed from home, you know what it actually feels like? It feels like a death in the family. When kids are taken out of their homes, that's how painful it is, you know, and we don't want to see anybody, any families have to experience that kind of pain. You know, Indian children, you know, they need Indian families, you know, because of our cultural ways, because of our language, our ceremonies, everything we do, you know, it always involves our children with our circle, our family circle of life. See, a lot of the Anishinaabe people, the indigenous people, come from clans, come from the animals. Like, I'm a Mukwa, I'm a bear clan. You know, there's a lot of different animal clans. And these animals are with their families. You know, bears and bear cubs belong with bears. Wolves and wolf pups, they belong with wolves. You know, that's the way the Creator, I believe, intended everything to be. You know, and that's why, you know, I fully support and believe in this Ikwa and Mithpalas, you know, and what it stands for. You know, and hopefully people will understand, you know, the indigenous people's point of view and why we stand on these principles and morals and values is because of our upbringing. So, yeah, once again, you know, I'm thankful to be here today. I thank my Creator for giving me another day to come here and, you know, address, you know, all the staff, the senators, all intelligent people in this room today. You know, I'm honored to be able to have of your time to speak today. But I don't know what else I can really say. I said some words last week, and I don't want to run into anybody else's speaking time. So I say, Chimigwich, Abizin Dawi Aig, that's thank you for listening to me today. Thank you.
Chairman, thank you so much for your words, for being with us. We have Chairman Kevin Dupuy, if the chairman can make his way up. And once you get settled in, you can identify yourself, please, and please proceed with your testimony.
So glad to good morning. My name is Kevin Dupuy. I'm the chairman from the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. I'm here to testify in support of SF-667 under the MIFBA. I don't speak as eloquently as others. In it, to Chairman Jackson's point, a lot of things have been said over the last couple weeks. But when we are taught young, when we use our language and speak our language, we bring our ancestors forward. And for this, we bring them from the beginning. So I present myself to you as my ancestors standing behind me and our people. I'm going to use the term Anishinaabe. When I do that, I'm going to use it as indigenous in general, because we have our Dakota brothers and sisters also in the room. Start off, for 530 years, somebody has been telling us what's best for us. 530 years. And it's failed for 530 years. Some have talked about the history of our people through the boarding schools, the federal policies, the termination, the removal. We're the only group of people in this country that these laws or policies were implied upon or pursued to or forced on. The only group of people until World War II with the concentration camps of the Japanese people and African Americans. In a point of 400 years or more. But out-of-home placement on the removal process, I want you to picture, if you could please, somebody coming to your house and saying, you have three children. Which one of them are you going to give up today because they're going to a boarding school? Until they're 18 years old. And the percentage of them children that never made it home. That's the reality. And today it's in the world's lens to see what has happened to the indigenous people. The Indian Act started in the United States, moved into Canada, moved across the seas to Australia and New Zealand, but to only indigenous people. And today, the out-of-home placement is rampant. And the numbers that we can take a look at from out-of-home placement in the state of Minnesota and the country is tenfold compared to what happened in the boarding school. Compared to what happened in the boarding school. So the boarding school has never stopped. Different policies and processes have moved forward to call it something else. But the reality, it has never stopped. We as Anishinaabe people believe that we're tied to everything that grows. We believe everything has a spirit, inanimate and inanimate. So what that means basically is we're tied to everything that grows. And this term that we hear all the time about sovereignty, it's not a word with us. It's a way of life. Sovereignty means that I'm tied to completely everything. It's every part of my being. We were born sovereign, an inherent right. Just like everybody else, just like everybody in the world has a right to breathe clean air. Everybody has a right to drink clean water or fresh water. And we also believe that our children choose their parents. And for the ones who can understand it, that's what sovereignty is. Before the encroachment of the European, we had our own government processes. We had commerce. We had things that have been in place since the dawn of time. So it's nothing new to look at and say, this is how we govern ourselves. This is how we take care of our children. This is the way the Creator gave us. These are the things the Creator gave us. And so it's a simple principle as this. If you understand what I mean by being tied to the land and the structure, if I can't eat the animals or drink the water, one of my arm goes. If I can't take the animals that the Creator gave us in the woods, there goes one of my legs. For the Ojibwe people, we travel from the East Coast to the region. We are over a 500-year migration to come to one place of where we settled today, where the food grows on the water, and that's Manoman or wild rice. So if I can't eat that, there goes another leg. If I can't do these things, there goes my other arm. I cease to exist as an Anishinaabe. What I mean by Anishinaabe is how I am tied to everything that grows, how we are tied to everything that is part of us as a being from outside. And so when our children lose that, and they do, because of out-of-home placement, and some may disagree with the word that I'm going to use, but I'm going to use it as a simple principle, genocide. One form of genocide is to strip a culture away from a people. And when you take that child and you put that child in a home where they're not part of their way of life, they're not part of their speaking, they're not part of their culture, that's genocide. And I know some may disagree with this word, but you all have the ability to look it up for yourself. And that's one form of the simplest piece of genocide, is stripping a culture away from a human being. The idea was, and they use the term children, but it was Lieutenant Pratt, came up with an idea that says, kill the Indian and save the man. We'll kill the Indian and save the child. Call it what you want. It hasn't worked. And it's not working today. And that's the federal policies that were put into place to subdue the indigenous people. Why it's so easy for me to talk about this and not read anything is because this is what we live daily. This is what we live daily. I want to leave this with you all. No one man or group of people have the right to deny us our right to exist as who we are as a people, defined in the Constitution of the United States, defined in the treaties, supreme law of the land. We see you, but do you see us? Miigwech.
Chairman Dupuy, thank you so much for those remarks and for being with us. Chief Executive Melody Benjamin is our next tribal leader to address us. And Chief Executive Benjamin, if you can identify yourself once you get settled in, and we'll be eager to hear from you.
Buju Aninishnabe, Madame and Indigenous Cause Melanie Benjamin Indigo, Mino Gijigad Nugom. Mr. Chairman and Madam Chair, I am Melanie Benjamin, and I'm the Chief Executive of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. On behalf of the band, we respectfully request that you vote in favor of House File 1071 during the current legislative session. House File 1071 ensures that all the provisions of the Indian Child Welfare Act are expressly stated in Minnesota law to ensure continued protections for American Indian families and the 11 tribes in Minnesota. Congress enacted the Indian Child Welfare Act in 1978 to protect American Indian culture and tribal integrity from the domestic removal of American Indian children by public and private agencies, resulting in Indian children being placed in foster care and adoptive homes at the rate of 19 times higher than non-Indian children. And in some states, 85% of all American Indian children were placed in non-Indian homes. Indian Child Welfare has helped tens of thousands of Indian children and families find fairness and healing in state child welfare systems by establishing standards for proceedings involving Indian children. These standards include ensuring stability and security within Indian families, guaranteeing that tribal governments have a role in keeping Indian families together, and helping Indian children retain their cultural identity and heritage. Many of the policies that were created in an attempt to assimilate American Indian people and families failed or caused great harm. Boarding schools and the policies of removal and relocation of American Indian people disrupted our family structures and our cultural teachings and our ways of life. Every Native American family at Mille Lacs had a relative or an elder taken from the family and sent to boarding school. In my family, during the 1950s, we were relocated to St. Louis under the termination policies. The United States spent most of its history trying to destroy Indian families, but in 1978, they started to try to preserve Indian families. HF 1071 preserves the policy of keeping families together and allowing our families to flourish. In the long run, this will help us preserve our way of life, our language, and our culture. We urge you to support this bill. Miigwech. Thank you for listening this morning.
Chief Executive Benjamin, thank you so much for your testimony. Our fourth tribal leader we're going to hear from is joining us virtually, President Robert Larson. And so, President Larson, thank you so much. Identify yourself, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Mohammed Takiapi. Chair Pinto, Chair Becker Finn, I greet you with hello, my relatives. Dakotia, Tatanki, Choctaw, Tamiado, Chanshayapi, Edwati, Damakota, Ichewichashka. I say, in the Dakota way, we're all related. So I'm not going to give you facts and you're going to hear plenty of that, and you can look those up, but I just want to speak to you as a Ichewichashta, as a common man. I was given this title by my people, and this title specifically from the other men in this room as the president here at Lower Sioux. And with that, I just want to share that I want to try to keep this as positive as possible, because this is such an important piece for us. As Dakota, the original people of this land, we're not even supposed to be here, but we are still here. And this House File 1071 strengthening MIFPA, putting it into law only helps to try to do a little justice for our Dakota people and all the natives in this state. But according to the first governor of the state, we're not even supposed to be here. We are supposed to be exterminated. Not just exiled or gotten rid of, but exterminated is the word that he used. And today, you know, we know better, right? We're people, we're humans. And that's how I want to speak to you as a human to human. That when we learn better, we should do better. And our Dakota word for children is our Wakayanja. And that translates to English as like the sacred ones. They're vital for our existence. Taking them away and stripping them of their identity as Dakota people, like my brother Kevin said, it's a form of genocide. We can't continue that any longer. We need to work together to ensure that everybody in this state has a right to thrive. Without our children, there's no way we can thrive. And you can look up all the disparities. They're all there for you to see that this is one chance that you have to not take the children away, to help us live as relatives together. My family in particular, we've been foster parents for a few years, and we've been able to help 15 kids have come through our home. Two of them are my great nephews that we've actually adopted. So I'm not just saying this as a tribal leader. I'm saying this because I'm living it. My family's living it. Got plenty of relatives that have been in and out of the system, but not losing them. I can't imagine where they would be right now if it wasn't for the ability to bring them into our home. The chance that I wouldn't even know them. It just baffles me. So I ask you, as a relative, to pass House File 1071 in a good way. And there's so many more things that I would like to say, but I know there's many folks that have good words for you. So on behalf of Lower Sioux, our community and our council, I want to relay my appreciation for Rep. Keeler for asking me to even speak and authoring this file. It's our community's desire to strengthen MIFPA. So with that, in a good way, I say, Hamitakiasi, Padami Ado. Thank you.
Thank you, President Larson, for joining us and for your remarks. And our final tribal leader, Vice President Shelley Buck, if you can make your way to the front. And then as you get settled in, once you do, I'll ask you to identify yourself and then proceed once you've gotten settled in.
Chair Pinto, committee members, Hamataku Yepi, Chante Washteya Nape Chiyujapi, Dakota Ia Patewachoda Makiapie, Washichu Ia Shelley Buck Makiapie. Hello, my relatives. I greet you with a good heart and handshake. My Dakota name is Manny Buffalo. My English name is Shelley Buck. I'd like to first thank Representative Keeler and Senator Kunesh, as well as the Native Caucus, for their efforts on addressing Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act and the need to protect our children. I'm here today in support of House File 1071. If you're wondering why now is the time to act on this legislation, it's because we Dakota always look out for our next seven generations and push to keep our children safe with our cultural teachings in order to keep them on the right path. We want our children to learn to use the traditional medicines and ways of our ancestors, learn to speak the language our elders were beaten for speaking, and learn the ceremonies that connect us to the natural world. Our familial connection extends well beyond our Tiwahe or nuclear family.
Our familial connection extends to our Teoshpaye, which is our extended family, clan, band, and even the Oyate, the tribe or nation. The Teoshpaye and Oyate have a responsibility to our children, whether or not they are part of our Tiwahe. Right now, there is a serious threat to change that narrative for each and every one of our children who are going through hard times with their families. There is currently a case before the U.S. Supreme Court that is challenging the validity of ICWA, which is the foundation and inspiration of MIFPA. If the United States Supreme Court were to overturn this ruling, the protections that are in place to keep our children within our tribal communities and understanding who they are as Dakota people can have a dramatic impact, not only on the child and family, but also tribes. I was doing some research and I found an article on the American Medical Association, or AMA, website that says this kind of kinship care, quote, leads to fewer behavioral problems for children, fewer mental health disorders, and fewer placement disruptions when compared to children in non-kinship care, end quote. For a brief understanding of Prairie Island, we are currently just over 1,000 members, and just under 50% of those are under the age of 18. I want to stress that every child that is removed from our families, culture, and community, it has a dramatic impact on the growth of our people and greatly impacts the future of our members. Every tribal member is vital and plays a significant role in moving our community into the future. The implementation of this language will protect the future of our children and offer them the chance to be part of our community and learn to grow up in our way of life. Our families will not have to worry about the outcome of the United States Supreme Court ruling. Other states have looked to Minnesota since enacting on MIFPA, and they are looking at us now and seeing what Minnesota will do to make sure these protections continue to be in place for Native children. For my family personally, my grandmother and two of her sisters were taken from her father, and they were taken by the courts because he had his wife pass away, my great-grandmother. That is the reasoning why my grandmother and two of her sisters went into boarding school. Now my father and myself didn't learn the language. I'm learning the language now. Thankfully, my daughter is fluent in the language, and it's taken two generations to get there. That's the effect that these laws have on our children when you take them away from their families. I urge you to support House File 1071. Pidamaya Yepi for giving me the time to speak on such an important issue for our community and all tribes in the state of Minnesota.
Vice President Buck, thank you so much for joining us. And a special thank you to all the tribal leaders. It's really important that we have intergovernmental communication and relationships, and there could be no more important topic than this one. A slight change to the agenda. I'd like to ask Rebecca McConkie Green to come up at this point to just provide a walk through the bill. I think that's the plan, and then we'll hear from other testifiers, including Apuchi Petit. Rebecca McConkie Green, as you get settled in, please identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony and describing the bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Chair Pinto and Chair Becker-Finn, it's an honor to be here this morning. I have been, I'm Rebecca McConkie Green. I've been very honored to lead a group of tribal attorneys that worked on trying to make sure that we keep the very important provisions of the Indian Child Welfare Act in Minnesota law. As was mentioned, there's currently a challenge before the U.S. Supreme Court. One of those challenges is based on anti-commandeering. And so by making sure that all of the provisions of ICWA are enacted directly into Minnesota law, we protect against that challenge. And so that's what we are trying to do today. I am here, I want to thank Representative Keeler and Kozlowski and Representative Becker-Finn for their advocacy and help with moving this forward. I don't know the best way to do this. I was going to just walk through each of the provisions, unless you would rather just ask questions.
Yep, thumbs up from Chair Becker-Finn. Sounds good.
You know, what I would tell you is that we, for the most part, we are just putting into Minnesota law what is already requirements of federal law and the Indian Child Welfare Act. There are two areas.
McConkie, I might ask you, I think the microphone is maybe not picking you up quite so well, so if you just kind of, no problem. You can.
Is that better?
Yeah, you should be good. Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, good, thanks.
So as I was saying, what we are doing or asking to pass with House File 1071 is to codify all of the Indian Child Welfare Act into the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. When the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act was passed, and I think that was in 1985, it was done as a supplemental statute. So it does not contain all of the provisions of ICWA. It is focused primarily on application of ICWA to child protection proceedings, when ICWA, in fact, actually applies to many other types of proceedings. And it doesn't contain all of the provisions. So it will reference provisions, for example, placement preferences, without stating them. And so we need to fix that as things go forward. So the first thing that we did is add an applicability section, and that is 260.752. And that just basically clarifies that these provisions apply to any custody proceeding that is not between the child's parents or between the child's parent and an Indian custodian. So it doesn't apply to divorces, it doesn't apply to any type of custody between parents, but anybody else coming in to seek custody of an Indian child, these provisions would apply to. Okay, and so that is what that section does. Then we added a policy statement.
Maybe you can identify the sections as you go, just the numbers as you go, if that's possible.
Certainly.
To help folks.
So the applicability section is 260.752.
Okay, or section one of the bill, I guess. Yeah, because that's what folks have, if that makes sense.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
What I'm saying is that sounds like you were talking about section one of the bill, and I think you're moving now to sections one and two, and now moving to section three of the bill on page two?
Section three, yes. Now I see what you mean. Thank you. So on page two, and this is 260.754, we added a policy on tribal-state relations, and this is to ensure recognition of the sovereignty of the tribes. And so that is what that section does. We did some, then in section four, we did a little bit of clarity about the active efforts provision. I think they were just kind of basic, some very basic tweaking of language. We added a definition under subdivision 3A. This is on page 3 for child placing agency. And so this is to make sure that the bill applies to all types of custody actions that are not between the parents. We defined child placement and child custody. Those are subdivisions 3B and 4A. Emergency proceeding is subdivision 5A, and extended family member. These are some definitions that were in the Indian Child Welfare Act and that we brought into Minnesota law. The next one is subdivision 6A, and that is a definition of imminent physical damage or harm. An imminent physical damage or harm is a term of art that is used in the Indian Child Welfare Act in the section on emergency removals. This is a very important term because this standard has to be met in order to trigger the bypasses that are in the emergency removal section. Everybody wants to ensure that children are safe. That is as important, as you've heard from the tribal leaders this morning, to them as it is to the state actors as well. We all want to make sure kids are safe. But in the emergency removal sections, there are some bypasses that would basically undo the Indian Child Welfare Act provisions if they're not followed. And those things are making sure that the tribe is notified, making sure that the parents are served and notified, making sure that active efforts are provided whenever possible to remove children, and making sure that there's consultation with the tribe. Obviously, in emergencies, we want to make sure that the children are safe, and that's why the emergency provisions are there. But it's very important that they be used very sparingly. Most of the tribes in Minnesota work very hard to be there to help provide services for their families, to make sure that kids stay with their families as often as possible. And we want to ensure that that happens and that we have as few removals as possible. And so that's why that term was actually defined in this version, where it is not in the Indian Child Welfare Act. So that is new. Otherwise, I think the definitions largely come directly from the Act. Then on page 5, section 15, is the emergency removal or placement of Indian children, termination and appropriate actions. These are sections that came out of the Indian Child Welfare Act because we did not have them in NIFLA before. So those were added in. And that is really what most of this is as I go through each of these sections. Subdivision 4, I think, well, it has the different requirements for emergency removals. Subdivision 3 is the petition and what needs to be in that. Subdivision 4 requires proceedings and review of whether the emergency removal continues to be necessary in subdivisions 4 and 5. Then we move to section 16. This is on page 7. And this is, we did some tweaking of the notice provisions. In 2015, there were some amendments that had been passed requiring inquiry into tribal lineage, and that remains. But we wanted to make sure that this section applies not just to social service agencies again, but to anybody who would be a petitioner seeking third-party custody or custody that is not between the parents. And that is, what was it, that section? So it goes through in this for several pages, laying out the different types of proceedings that can happen and reiterating the fact that notice is required in all of those and what the standard of proof is. And the standards of proof are, again, consistent with the Indian Child Welfare Act. So moving, I guess, next to section 17 on page 11, we just had a slight word change. And I think section 18, also on page 11, we did add some language that stated that when the proceedings are completely voluntary, when, for example, in situations where you have somebody voluntarily placing their children with a family member or with someone else, that the active efforts are not required when that happens. On page 12, subdivision 3, is language about findings that active efforts were provided, and that is what has been added there. And again, most of the provisions in this area were previously added into MIFPA in 2015. There's some slight language adjustments throughout to ensure that it is applied properly to all of the types of proceedings it would apply to. We added in on page 14, subdivision 1B, access to files, and this is again provisions that came in from the Indian Child Welfare Act about ensuring that the tribe has access to the information about the case. And I apologize, I am kind of skipping over the places where there's just minor language changes because I think you'll get that. Subdivision 3A is on page 15, and that is, again, coming out of ICWA and laying out what the court's requirement for consent when parents are consenting to voluntary foster care placement or voluntary termination of parental rights. We also, subdivision 4, added the requirements about withdrawal of consent to voluntary placements and return of the children to their parents when that consent is withdrawn. Those things come, again, from the Indian Child Welfare Act. Subdivision 4A, withdrawal of consent to voluntary termination of parental rights and adoptive placement and return of custody, that also comes directly from the Indian Child Welfare Act. Subdivision 4B, these are on page 16, collateral attack, vacation of decree, and return of custody. These also come from the Indian Child Welfare Act and I think are similar to some other provisions in Minnesota law when there's been fraud and something that has happened. So then in also on page 16, section 27 starts the description of involuntary child placing proceedings, and we added some language about where, and these again come from the Indian Child Welfare Act, where there's exclusive jurisdiction by the tribe unless they agree to allow concurrent jurisdiction, and where there's concurrent jurisdiction of the tribe with the tribe. We added the language about placement preferences, identification of extended family members, notices of hearings, right of intervention, and appointment of counsel. These are all subdivisions that are listed. They're 1B through 2B on page 17 and all come from the Indian Child Welfare Act. On page 18, starting with 2C, we have examination of reports and other documents, again from the Indian Child Welfare Act. 2D is tribal access to files and other documents, again from the Indian Child Welfare Act. Transfer of proceedings, again from the Indian Child Welfare Act. I think the next place that there were changes is subdivision 4, effective tribal court placement orders. We just clarified some language about giving full faith and credit to tribal court placement orders and to other things from the tribe's jurisdiction, such as recognition of their laws and other issues. Then in subdivision 6, we did do some clarity about a concept of qualified expert witness and evidentiary requirements for different types of proceedings. So this takes a little bit of explanation. The Indian Child Welfare Act lays out different types of child protection proceedings and other types of custody proceedings where the act applies. And it defines those as foster care placements, termination of parental rights, pre-adoptive placements, and adoptive placements. It's important to look very closely, though, at the definition for foster care placements, because that, in both case law and in practice, have been found to be much more expansive than how, when we are using the common language usage of the word foster care placement, we tend to describe those. So it actually includes any time that a child is placed out of the care of their parent or Indian custodian, and where the parent or Indian custodian cannot have them returned upon request, and where rights have not yet been terminated. So when you think about it, and what the case law has shown is that that includes, in fact it states in the definition, it includes guardianships, and so those apply to third-party custody actions. We have case law clarifying that. It applies to guardianships. It applies to any time, basically, a child is involuntarily placed away from their parents and the parents can't get them back, but yet the rights have not been terminated to the parents. So that is very expansive, and why then we had to clarify when we move further into the statute. It requires qualified expert witness testimony when you're placing a child in a foster care placement and when you're terminating parental rights of the child, of the parents to the child. So in Minnesota, we have a lot of different types of placements or foster placements that happen that aren't called that. As I said, guardianships, transfer of legal and physical custody, transfer of custody to the agency, whether permanent or temporary, would all be types of foster care placements. The tribes have had kind of an ongoing struggle where we believe that qualified expert witness testimony should be provided, and I believe on a nationwide level that is the general consensus. So we want to make sure that that's clear in the law, that when kids are being placed in foster care during a child protection proceeding or placed in some other type of proceeding with somebody other than their parents, that there is QEW from the tribe and notice to the tribe supporting that placement. And specifically, the QEW testimony is talking about that the child would suffer serious physical and emotional harm if left in the care of their parents. That's what the QEW testimony talks about in those places. So it is necessary in all of those, and including the permanency actions such as the transfers of custody. So this clarifies, this goes through and clarifies that QEW is needed in each of those types of placements.
And Judge McConkie-Green, we should probably wrap up pretty quickly. We've got lot of testifiers. Yeah, no problem. But yeah, thank you.
I think I will just briefly, we have I think I've covered the provisions that are a little bit different from ICWA. The rest of the things come, I believe, very closely from the Indian Child Welfare Act and were tweaked for Minnesota law. And so that's what we have. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you so much, Professor. Yeah, we're going to proceed with testimony. I continue with testimony now. Okay. But I know that when the two committees have discussion on the bill, we'll have the planets have some folks available to answer questions at that time. Thank you so much, Judge Mataki-Green. I'm going to invite up Opichi Petit. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the name correctly. Actually, I guess joining us virtually, pardon me. And I'll just note, the hearing is scheduled to run until 10 a.m. We have 14 testifiers, and so I'm going to be asking folks to keep their remarks to 2 minutes, and I'll be pretty strict about that. I may be more flexible, especially with this first testifier, who's a young person. Of course, it's so important to hear from. But I'll just sort of warn future testifiers. I will not mean to be rude, but do want to make sure to keep us on track. So Opichi Petit, I think, is joining us. Oh, I'm sorry, you're right up front. I'm sorry. And so please identify yourself and then and welcome. So glad to have you with us. And then proceed with your testimony.
Bonjour, Opichi, Indigenous Cause. I am a Fond du Lac band member. When I was 13, my brother and I were put into foster care. After I got put into foster care, I went to my grandma's and my uncle's. I was going through a lot and ran away. I was also an addict. Then I had to go to residential. I was separated from my brother. Staying with my family and being close to or on my reservation, I got to smudge and pray the way I normally would. In residential placement, even though they said I would be able to, I couldn't. After I finished residential, my tribal worker fought for me to be able to come home to my family while we took visits and stuff with my dad slowly. If my tribal worker wouldn't have fought for me to come home, I would have gone to a group home. My dad finished everything they asked him to do, and he finally got custody of me and my brother. If ICWA and MIFPA weren't in place, I probably wouldn't be here talking to you today. I am on a honor roll. I have a job working on getting my license, and I live with my dad and brother and see all my family all the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us and for sharing your experience. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much. So we'll move to other folks. I'll ask if you sort of see your name on the list, if you can be ready to speak. We've got Patricia Stain is the next person with us. So make your way forward, please. And I might ask Bobby Jo Marjorie Potter to come up front as well, just to be ready to go afterwards. But Patricia Stain, let's see, once you get settled in. And so please identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Patricia Stain, and I come to you today as a community member impacted by the laws that have happened in our country. I also come to you as a social work professional. I've worked in the child welfare field since 2004 in a variety of settings. I'm a relative care provider. I have custody of a couple of my relatives. And as others have stated, I've provided foster care with my family for a number of years. Codifying MIFBA in this way, I think, will be very helpful just in the way that we're able to approach our families and our relatives. You know, last week I listened to the testifiers, and there was a lot of very powerful things that were said. And one thing that stuck with me was when Senator Abler said, if I quit reading the history, I feel okay because I kind of forget. And that really stuck with me because that's an option for other people, right? You get to kind of forget. But this is our everyday life. I work in an agency that sometimes people think, oh, it's just our agency, and people are just getting down on our agency and how poorly we're doing, and we're really trying, and I have to constantly remind people, my colleagues, that are trying to do better by telling them. Telling them that our culture is healing. That, yes, you're trying to do better, but this act and this stuff that's going before the Supreme Court on the national level is bigger than one agency. This is bigger than one family, one worker. This is Indana Kubajanag. That's my ancestors, both before me and in front of me. And that's for all of my relatives. We all always have to be really mindful of our authority and the direction and the path that we put other people on, regardless of what our role is. Whether we're in human services or whether we're at the state level like you all are, we have authority. And we can set people on a path. So we have to be mindful of that. At the ICWA congressional hearings, we do this training, right, where we teach up-and-coming social work professionals. And we watch a video, and I remember watching a video, and an elder had stated in the congressional hearings for ICWA, it's a well-known fact that you all get to go home to your children, and you get to take your children home, and that's all that we want. We want to be able to take our children home so they can learn their language. My introduction speech, I told a group of people yesterday, it took me 15.7 miles to learn that because I ran in a trail and I was bound and determined to learn my introduction speech because that wasn't something that was given to me from a young age. I learned it in my 30s. The last thing that I just want to say, a concern that I have, and maybe you can help me understand that later, but I know in 260.762 subdivision 1, where it states active efforts are not required to prevent voluntary out-of-home placement and to affect voluntary permanency for the Indian child, I guess if we can just get some clarification on that, because I think it's our way to teach our up-and-coming social workers that they need to provide active efforts regardless. So that I would just like some clarification on that. But thank you. Miigwech Pizendawi Ik. I appreciate you listening.
Thank you so much for being with us. And I'd suggest you talk to Judge McConkie Green with that question. Babajo Marjorie Potter is up next, and I'll ask Gertrude Bukanaga to make your way to the front. And please identify yourself and proceed.
Buju, everybody. My name is Jawano Binesik, Indigenakaz, Makwa Ndudem Asabakone Zaga Iganing. I am so honored to be here today. And last time I testified, I shared some really personal stories about how being connected to culture has impacted my family. Today, I'd like to share my professional experience. And so we all have heard that pre-ICWA, the numbers for children and what was happening is that those white standards for how children should be raised and cared for was being applied unfairly to Indigenous families. I started my career off in 2009, and at that time, I was told, right, that we have to follow all of the laws, right? Child welfare, it's really important. But then I was really perplexed because I thought that federal laws applied to everybody. And then I started hearing people say, well, I'm not going to take that case because it's not ICWA, or because it's ICWA. I don't want to notify that tribe. I don't want to reach out. I witnessed workers getting police holds signed before they were leaving the building and assessing any families. And this was while MIFA and ICWA were a law that we had to follow. Time continued on, and those practices continued to damage and harm a community that I lived in and am from. Then we fast forward to 2015. At that time, our tribal leaders got together, and they amended MIFPA. And at that time, there was more accountability that came along with it. And I saw our county systems respond when money was being withheld and people started to react and change their policies and practices. And we've started to see positive impacts for the community. And so you wonder, why now? Why today? Well, for 40-some years, this law hasn't even been followed. And the moment that we start getting some accountability and seeing positive impacts for our family, it's under attack again. And I share my stories and my personal experience because those things are still going on today. 1 in 4 children are still being removed. I mean, we're supposed to assess the situation before we go out there. So if we apply that emergency standard in MIFPA, that's going to keep children safe and stop workers from getting police holds before they even go and assess the family. We are required to keep children in their homes, connected to their culture. That's what we signed up to do in social work. And I ask that you support this law and pass it and help to have other counties follow the law and the spirit that we're all speaking to today. So I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for joining us. and for your work. After the next testifier, Larissa Marie Littlewolf, is up, you can make your way to the front. But Gertrude Bukanaga, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Gertrude Bukanaga. I'm from the White Earth Tribal Nation, enrolled member, and I'm employed as executive director of Upper Midwest American Indian Center. I've been there since 1986, and I wore many hats in my day. I'm a mother, I'm a grandparent, and I'm an aunt to many children that have been in, and a grandma to many children who have been in out-of-home placement. I worked in several colleges, and when I worked at St. Catherine's College, I worked with about a number of 30 Indian women that were adopted by non-Indian people. They did not know their culture. They did not know their history. They did not know where they came from. It was a period of time when you couldn't find out how you were adopted or how you were taken from your family. In 1946, my mother had an accident and she passed to the spirit world. We were sent to boarding school. I was in a boarding school since 1946 with four of my other siblings. The youngest two stayed with an uncle. I know that, and I've lived the life of an Indian with all the laws that were passed to keep Indian families separated. Our family was separated from our parents, our grandparents, our cousins, our aunts, our uncles, and our friends when we went to boarding school. We were not allowed to visit homes or visit. We stayed there, and they determined what religion we would have. When I was growing up on White Earth, my mother and my family practiced the Indian culture and did their ceremonies and spiritual activities. Indians are very spiritual. This morning, before we came in here, before this meeting started, we had a traditional Indian prayer. Sometimes, a long time ago, Indian people used to smoke. We would have a pipe, and people would smoke with the non-Indian people and come to an agreement, or they would meet with other people. The history of Indian people has been different. I want to thank the tribal chairmen who were here this morning and spoke, because they're elected people of tribal nations, sovereign nations. There are over 574 tribes in the United States of America, and each one has their own elected leader, chairperson. At one time, we called them chiefs. We had a meeting in Leech Lake, and I think it was in November, when we talked about, people that are enrolled. And they said, well, maybe we ought to go back to in history. I said, well, the chiefs are the ones that, made all the rules and the regulations for each nation. So we had, a lot of people never studied the history. They never studied all the rules that for Indian people who went to boarding schools. In 1947, we went home that summer for 2 months. And then in August, we went back to boarding school, and we never went home again. So we were kept from our families. And and they did not treat Indian children that well in the boarding school. I went to school with my best friend was Audrey Banks, and her brother was Dennis Banks. And him and I used to joke around. And I'd say, well, how many times did you go through the paddle line? Because what they did to our boys in boarding school, they made up two lines if they didn't violated a rule. And they would get 10 to 15 or people in two lines. And they would give each boy a paddle. So when the boy got punished, he had to run through these double lines and get hit but with a paddle. And the girls were not treated any better. So me and my friend Audrey, we used to go to the library every day. Because nobody bothered you in the library. So, you know, you didn't violate no rules or anything. But we were not allowed to speak our language or practice our culture or do our ceremonies while we were in boarding school.
Ms. Buganaga,
separated from our families.
Ms. Buganaga, I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up if you can. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
If you want me to stop, I'll stop.
I have a lot to say because oh, I know.
I think the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act and the Indian Child Welfare Act have done a lot to keep families together and to practice their culture, and that's what I'm here today is to support this law, and I hope you support it too. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Although you were talking about difficult things, I have to say I could hear you, I could listen to you talk all day. I think maybe that's true of other people too. I really could. And so we've got, I'm just again going to ask folks to really keep your remarks just to under 2 minutes if you can. We're getting very tight on time. Amelia Carroll Lagarde is going to be up after the next testifier. But Larissa Marie Littlewolf, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
So my name is Larissa Littlewolf, and I come to you both as a professional and relative. Professionally, I'm the Associate Director of the Tribal Training and Certification Partnership at UMD. As a person, I am an auntie and a cousin and a community member and a relative. But most importantly, I am a mom. I'm a mom of three beautiful Indigenous babies who are amazing and wonderful, and they would be protected if by ICWA and MIFPA if they ever enter the system. And that makes me happy. That they would have that protection. I've worked in child welfare for 10 years, tribal child welfare for 10 years, and I've seen the significant impact that both these acts have had on our families and our communities. I have witnessed county agencies providing active efforts in keeping our babies home, but I've also seen county agencies be out of compliance with both of these acts. And that's when our relatives have been lost to the system. That's when our relatives have never come home. And so I often wonder who we lost. Right, I often wonder what gifts were taken from us as a community and as relatives when our children are placed away from their homes and their relatives. I have seen what happens when Indigenous families are not protected by ICWA and MIFPA, and it's scary. I have seen that reasonable efforts are not enough to help heal the contemporary and historical traumas that exist due to the genocidal practices of the U.S. government. We know that Indigenous children were targeted and removed from their families and communities through the boarding school era, the Indian Adoption Project, and by the foster care system. Indigenous children were removed from their homes and placed in white homes in an attempt to civilize them and assimilate them. There's propaganda and historical documents that show this. When Indigenous children were forcibly removed, they weren't allowed to practice their culture or their language. They weren't allowed to know their relatives or know their family. And generational trauma was created by these genocidal practices. And our children were stripped of their identities. But we continue to heal, right? We continue to create healthy communities. We continue to reclaim our knowledge, our culture, our teachings, and our language. We continue to grow as sovereign nations and Indigenous communities. But we need our children and our families home to do this and to continue to do this. Our children are our future lawyers, doctors, teachers, spiritual leaders, and our future politicians, and we know their needs better than any system ever could. We will always be more invested in the children in our community more than any system ever could. So I ask for your support.
Thank you so much. Joe Lesh is going to be up next, but first, Amelia Lagarde, if you can identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Buju gichi gami gaboi kwe anishinabe winikaz, makwa indudam gichi unigamina donjabwa, nagachi wananginda. My name is Amelia Lagarde, and I'm of the Bear Clan, and my family comes from Grand Portage. I currently live on the Fond du Lac Reservation with my three children. My three children who get to know their names and their traditions and their cultures. And it's not lost on me that today I get to sit here before you all with my children at home. We talk about our historical trauma that we've experienced, and I think about our grandmothers that sat before Congress just over 40 years ago, asking not for their children to stay home, but for their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. And now here today, I have the opportunity to sit here with my children in my home and think about my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren and the generations to come. You've heard other people testify about how ICWA is under attack and the need for our children to stay in our homes and our communities, because they're our future, right? They're our greatest resource, and not a resource of commodity, but a resource of our future and our existence. You have here today so many people, as I look around, as we continue to be here, and we continue to survive despite efforts to eradicate us and exterminate us. We're here, and our grandchildren are here, and my children are here, and the children that I serve as a child welfare social worker, they deserve to have these same rights. We talk about these little spirit beings picking their parents, right, in the spirit world, choosing their moms and their dads. But not only are they choosing their moms and their dads, but they're choosing their parents and their communities. And it's essential that we not deprive the children of those connections, but we don't deprive the communities of those connections either, right? As Ms. Little Wolf just referenced, we know what's best for our children, and we have an investment in them and our future. So, Miigwech, thank you for listening.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Tanya Long is going to be up next after the next testifier. And Joe Lesh, please identify yourself and proceed.
Aloha and good morning. My name is Jill Kehaulani-Esh. I am Native Hawaiian since 2013. I've had the privilege of being the ombudsperson for American Indian Families. In 2021, this legislative body created the Office of Ombudspersons for American Indian Families, the only independent state agency of its kind in the United States. This is pursuant to Minnesota Statute 3.9215. I'm here today in my official capacity to speak in support of House Bill 1071 to strengthen the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. By this legislature codifying ICWA into MIFPA, it will allow MIFPA to be a standalone statute, because we do not know what the United States Supreme Court will do in the Brackeen case and what will happen to ICWA. It is important to pass this legislation as soon as possible, because the United States Supreme Court opinion can come down any day now. In my role as the ombudsperson, I've traveled the state to observe court proceedings, especially when a county has filed a petition to terminate a parent's right. While I am a licensed Minnesota attorney, I'm not the attorney for anyone who contacts me. However, I can provide information resources. There have been court proceedings that I attended when judges have called me up to the bench to ask me about ICWA and MIFPA. A number of judges and attorneys have asked me, why aren't all the laws and statutes in one statute instead of having to look at ICWA and then having to look at MIFPA? By this legislative body codifying ICWA into MIFPA, this will put all the laws in one statute. Of course, the judge should still refer to the Bureau of Indian Affairs regulations, which provides additional information. But by ICWA being codified into MIFPA, it will not only strengthen MIFPA, but have all the statutes in one place. In my remaining 15 seconds of my testimony, I'd like to direct everyone to the written testimony of grandmother Claudia Herrera. Unfortunately, she was not able to attend because she had to work. This grandmother contacted me at 7 p.m. on Monday. This is several years ago. She shared that she was looking for information resources because she was just told by the county that the judge was signing an order on Wednesday morning, less than 40 hours from when she called
me. Thank you.
She said it was an order transferring custody of her American Indian grandson to a family who is not related to him and who are not Native. So please read her testimony. She titled it, "If Not for ICWA and MIFPA, I would have lost my grandson. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I will encourage folks to read both that, and I think there's a lot of written testimony that's been submitted. Thank you so much for directing our attention there. After the next testifier, we'll be turning to virtual testimony, starting with Dolores Gabbard. But first, Tanya Long, identify yourself, please, and proceed.
Good morning, and thank you. My name is Tanya Long, and I don't want to be disrespectful, so I say hello to all my relatives. That includes everyone in this room. I am Omaha, a member of that tribe that is currently, well, is now in Nebraska. I am an Army veteran. I have a law degree, undergrad. Worked very, I guess, successful in the views of some people. But what most importantly I want to come here and speak about is that I am a foster care survivor. I was removed from my family before ICWA was enacted. I was placed in 5 foster homes with my 4 siblings. The very first day, I was sexually abused. I was physically abused. I was mentally abused. And I was transferred, we were transferred around and around because it was 5 of us in many homes. All this was done while my grandfather had a 3-bedroom home on the reservation where we could have lived. Not once were they considered. I support this bill. I'm angry about how it got to the Supreme Court. And legally, I do have a law degree. I don't agree with the arguments against ICWA. I just say that because of foster care, I didn't have my language, I lost it. I missed a lot of ceremonies, and as an adult, I had to go back and learn them. I am still learning my language. I worked for our children. I became a foster parent because I didn't see American Indian foster homes. I became a guardian ad litem because I did not see American Indian guardian ad litems. And I continue to be a foster home where I've had 25 children in the last 18 years. I've taken custody of 4 of them. I've had Ojibwe, Lakota, Rosebud, Dakota, Anishinaabe, which I all take them to their people and their spiritual leaders and advisors so that they can have their culture. I take them to their cultural events and take them to their ceremonies. This is very, very crucial so that we do not become extinct and that we don't lose our language, culture, and our connectivity to our lands. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your testimony. Returning to the virtual testifiers then, Dolores Gabbard and Curtis Jackson will be up after that. And I'll ask folks to be very, very brief if you can, as we're very tight on time. But Dolores Gabbard, thank you for joining us. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Homatakiopi, Dolores Gabbard in Lakiepi. Good morning. I come to you with many different hats, but today I'm wearing the hats of a foster parent and also a school representative that works with Native American children. One of the things that brought us into foster care is that, you know, we have this belief that it is a traditional value to be good relatives and to take in children because we have the means to be able to do so. We've had approximately 15 to 20 children in our home. Most recently, we've fostered 3 newborns over the past 4 years. So lots of baby holding, and that's been great. I wanted to point out, though, that, you know, foster care is not a route for adoption, and we know this. We believe that the best place for the children that come into our home is with their families. I have unfortunately come across some families that have shared that they discontinued fostering because the children always went home. And so I remind them that, you know, reunification, you know, is the ultimate goal, you know. And so I just wanted to point out that our most recent foster care placement was through Beltrami County. And we had the opportunity to set up our own Zoom meetings with the parentals so that we could have a little bit of open communication. And I think that was really powerful because, you know, being able to work as a family together. And in those Zoom meetings, it was amazing to be able to talk about what we were serving for dinner you know, and saying, you know, we're going to have fried bread and soup for supper, and knowing that the family. Yes?
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up. I'm so sorry. We're at the 2-minute mark.
Oh, wow, that was fast. Yeah. Okay. Well, I can be done. That's fine.
Okay. I'm so sorry. I know that there's so much to talk about here. I'm going to ask Curtis Jackson to come up next and Deanna Drift. Virtually, that is. Deanna Drift will be after that, if I'm saying your name right. But Curtis Jackson, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning to all my relatives on Turtle Island. My name is Curtis Jackson, and there is a picture of me in my first day in recovery, along with my children and my family today. My story is from termination to a father's purpose. My name is Curtis Jackson, a person in long-term recovery for almost 7 years. I'm an enrolled member of Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I'm a father to 5 beautiful children, ages 23, 12, 8, 5, and 1. I am writing to support the Minnesota State Legislature strengthening the Minnesota Indian Preservation Act. One of the greatest tragedies in life is to believe we don't have a purpose. From a young age, I knew my purpose was to be a father. As an American Indian father fighting for an opportunity to be a custodial parent, I did not have the knowledge to advocate for myself and my children effectively. With the assistance of the Ombudsman Person for American Indian Families, I was provided with the resources and information to advocate for my purpose adequately. I met Ms. Jill Esk in 2017, and I was very frustrated with Itasca County and the social workers involved in my CPS case. Termination was all that I heard from the moment I started my journey. On February 26, 2016, I was working my case plan diligently and attending all my court appearances faithfully to no avail. The guardian ad litem did not believe I could care for my children for more than 3 hours and believed the out-of-home, off-the-reservation placement was the best option. I feel that they were ignorant and naive to the idea of my children being raised by a man who struggled with substance use disorder and mental health. MIFPA and ICWA provided me with the guidelines to bring to surface numerous violations and prove they were not following active efforts. On July 28, 2017, my babies and I were reunited. I feel it would be very traumatic for future fathers to not have the ruling to protect the future of their families. Fathers are rarely given a chance to be custodial parents. However, ICWA and MIFPA do not discriminate against fathers. With mental health issues and substance use disorders plaguing our tribal members, it is vital to the preservation of American Indian families to have these monumental safeguards in place. Please vote to strengthen MIFPA for not only for fathers, mothers, grandparents, but also for our babies. Our babies need us. Respectfully, Curtis Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Thank you. Deanna Drift is up next, and then Braveheart will be after that. Ms. Drift. Please proceed.
Are you ready? Oh, sorry. Mr. Chair and members, Anin Gejinaku Indigenous Cause. Hi, my name is Deanna Drift. Ginuji Dudem, Northern Pike is my clan. Manawa Asubikune Zaga Iganing in Dunjaba. I'm from Net Lake. I'm an enrolled member of the Boys Fort Band of Chippewa. I'm very honored to be here today to give you a small glimpse into the importance of House File 1071. I support this bill because it aims to strengthen the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, MIFPA. Child Protection Services removed my brother's children and placed them with me. This is the law. But for us, the American Indian community, it is customary within our culture. An aunt is a second mother to our nieces and nephews. We play a vital role in their upbringing. If it weren't for the Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA, and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, my family would have been lost to the system. My nieces and nephews never experiencing that sense of belonging or feeling that connection to the Native family and heritage. Because of active efforts and how hard my brother worked his case plan, he has full custody of all 4 of his children, ranging from ages 3 to 12. They are immersed in our culture, learning our language, and continuing on the path of healing from historical trauma. This is why HF 1071, codifying ICWA into MIFPA, is important to us, because if it is passed, it will continue to preserve the American Indian family. Our children are our future. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Lynn Braveheart is up next, and Emily Esther Rivera after that. Lynn Braveheart, please proceed.
Thank you. Han Matakiapi. Excuse me. Hello, relatives. I just, sorry.
My name is Lynn Braveheart. I'm a member of the Oglala Lakota Nation of Pine Ridge, South Dakota. I'm also the State of Minnesota Guardian Ad Litem Program ICWA Division Manager. I'm also the St. Paul Rep for the ICWA Advisory Council. I come here today to support the passage of the amendments to MIFBA. These amendments are so important, as you all have heard, with the current attacks on ICWA. I worked on the case that is up in with the Supreme Court, our Minnesota case, and it's really a passion of mine for the creation of our ICWA division with the Guardian Ad Litem program. We started it 2 years ago, actually October 2022 is when we had our first strategic plan, realizing that Guardian Ad Litems across the country have been the weakest link in ICWA. That is what someone from the Native American Rights Fund, who is working on the defending ICWA at the Supreme Court right now, said to me at a conference, a NICWA conference. And it really broke my heart as being a guardian ad litem at the time. And then I realized how terrible the compliance across the state is, not only with our own guardian ad litem program, but with social services, county attorneys, judges. If you want it, in my opinion, as a person that's also grown up in foster care, I've aged out of foster care. My mother was removed during the Indian Adoption Project. One of the biggest reasons why we have the numbers we have is because of the lack of training and the lack of compliance. Just a few weeks ago, a county attorney said to one of my ICWA guardians, I don't know what this QEW thingy is, a QEW thingy. It's just offensive. Red Lake Nation had to have a judge removed from one of their ICWA cases because he didn't even know how to follow the case. And it went up to a higher court where they did remove that judge from that ICWA case.
Ms. Braveheart, I'll have to ask you, and I'm so sorry.
I definitely support this. It's so important. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing your testimony, your experience. Emily Esther Rivera is our final virtual testifier. If you can please proceed.
Thank you. Hello, chairs and committee members. It is an honor to be with you here today. My name is Emily Rivera. I'm here as a citizen to speak in favor of House File 1071. I also have multiple hats. I serve on the Guardian Ad Litem Board as well.
Ms. Rivera, can you lean in closer to your microphone?
Yes, is that better?
A tiny bit, but please proceed.
I'll speak louder. Thank you. I'm seeking to support amending the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. This proposed legislation is very important, as you heard today. I live in Bemidji, which is in Beltrami County. And Beltrami County has 668 of their 775 children who are in out-of-home placement are American Indian. That's 86% of the out-of-home placement are American Indian in Beltrami County. Now, there are needs, as were spoken today, to make sure that the legislation, it needs to be applied equitably across the state. And we see by the numbers that might not be the case. And so codifying the language is going to be really important for the equitable provision of services throughout the state. These vital protections within ICWA need to remain accessible for American Indian children, families, and tribes within Minnesota. And out of respect for time, I just will end there saying that please vote to approve this piece of legislation. It is critical to the sovereignty and the well-being, the safety, and the permanency of children. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I'm asking Samantha Gorman to come on up. And also just want to apologize to members that we're running a little bit long. We've got a lot of folks I'm sharing. So Samantha Gorman, please proceed with your testimony. If we have Samantha Gorman coming up, perhaps, maybe not. Okay. And so then I know we had one testifier who had signed up, but we missed. So Laura York, please identify yourself and proceed.
Bonjour, mi guanagabo ikwain indigena kaz, migazine in duertem, goabu ganikag in duenjiba, nimin wendam oma yayan nungum. Hello everyone, my name is Laura York, and I am the American Indian Child Welfare Advisory Council co-chair. And I know we're short on time here, so I'll try to make it very quick. but I think it's important to understand the process and how we got here. So in 2018 and 2019, the American Indian Child Welfare Advisory Council, along with the American Indian Chemical Dependency Council and the American Indian Mental Health Council came together to discuss the issues that were impacting American Indian children and families. During those tribal visioning sessions, there was a recommendation to strengthen MIFPA. And since then, with the ICWA Supreme Court case that is going on, we had expedited that process in response. Currently, the U.S. Supreme Court is challenging ICWA, the foundation for MIFPA. The challenges are based on equal protections, anti-commandeering, and the Commerce Clause arguments. MIFPA does not include a severability clause and is currently supplemental to ICWA instead of a standalone statute. The anti-commandeering and Commerce Clause arguments can be addressed with the passage of this state law. The proposed changes are necessary to ensure protections for Indian children and families and tribes in response to the U.S. Supreme Court challenge. Additional changes will follow in the subsequent legislative year. This year's legislative proposal incorporates the gold standard existing protections of ICWA into Minnesota statutes to include the effectively work at protecting Indian families and reduce litigation where possible and provide more clarity so everyone involved has the same expectations and understandings of their rights and responsibilities. It is to ensure the protections of ICWA are protected so Indian tribes and families do not lose any more children in the event that this federal law is struck down. Minnesota is one of few states that actually has an Indian Family Preservation Act in place, and other states around the nation are going to be looking to model this MIFPA. This is really important because we have ICWA-eligible cases throughout the United States impacting all of our tribes. And Minnesota might be in a better place than most, but it's really important that we pass House File 1071 this legislative session. The work group...
We'll kind of need to wrap up, I'm afraid. Yeah.
I will. So the work group included recommendations from a tribal state agreement from our tribal leaders. The work group consisted of the...
I'm so sorry. Can you send information out about the work group? But just, I do need to have you wrap up. I'm so sorry.
Yep.
It's
really important, I think, of the collaboration to why we brought this forward this year, and it is the Minnesota Department of Health and Human Services, the Minnesota Associations of Counties Social Service Administrators, and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association that came together to work along with our tribal attorneys in this process. Miigwech, okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much to you. Thank you for your work as well. This is a little bit of a scary question at this time, but is there any member of the public who wishes to testify on the bill? There is right over there. I'm going to ask you to be head on up. You timed yourself, okay. We'll see if your timing of yourself matches matches my necessary timing. But so I'm going to ask you to keep it to 90 seconds or so. But please identify yourself and proceed.
Sure, she's got a timer.
I'm going to time myself for accountability, so I appreciate the opportunity. Anin Bujou, Gwaymakoons Indigenous Cause.
Can you identify yourself? Oh, yeah, yes, you are. Yeah.
Maklin and Dudem, St. Paul and Dunjaba. Hello, everyone. My English name is Mika Barrett. I'm humbled to be here, to have been asked or to volunteer to testify for my people and to be in a room full of community that I have watched and idolized during my 29 years on this earth. Thank you for giving me this time to share my story. I'm a third-generation social worker, third-generation master's of social work, and a third-generation dedicated to the work of serving our relatives affected by the system in my family. It all started with my great aunt, Muriel Charlo, a member of the Fond du Lac Nation, a servant for her community and one of the original people to bring the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act to our state. We called her Auntie Mo. She had this fire about her. She was small, but she was mighty. She was one of the strongest advocates for the safety and wellness of Native children. She took in my mom and raised her as her own, introducing her to our Anishinaabe ways of life, and later influencing my mother to be a social worker. Due to these two women, I knew my path. I set goals to achieve a master's degree and worked my way to achieve it while being a mom of two. I worked for my tribal nation, the Red Lake Nation, at a grad school and worked with tribal members across the country. Currently, I'm a supervisor with the Indian Child Welfare Unit at Ramsey County. I was hesitant to take this role, but I felt the wrath of my Auntie Mo. I had to do it for her and all the work that she has done prior when protecting the interests of our relatives. I'm working to change our county involvement with our relatives in the community, educating county employees, building an elite ICWA team, uplifting relatives, implementing active efforts to the fullest capacity, and trying new efforts that have been done that have not been done before.
And Ms. Bear, we'll have to have you wrap up. I'm yes, so sorry, we're the 2-minute mark.
No, I'm sorry, I apologize. I went back and forth all weekend trying to get my introverted self to talk today, but Auntie Mo has been gone for nearly 18 years, and I feel her giving me the power and strength to be here and tell my story. And I encourage you lawmakers to make the right choice today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask the bill's author, Representative Keeler, to just wrap us up. And thank you so much. And thanks to all the testifiers. I'm incredible. Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you. Having us share massive amounts of pain in 2 minutes is extremely difficult, and I know that that's hard, but I appreciate you all staying a couple extra minutes. It's funny how oftentimes I show up in spaces and people will say, wow, y'all are so resilient, and we're tired. We're tired of having to be resilient. We're tired of showing up and being the conversation at every table that, I mean, you can look at every data point and you know that we're struggling. And I think you have to ask yourself, would we be struggling so bad if there wasn't this continued genocide working against us? Minnesota has done really well in setting the stature for and the standard for MIFBA. We need to strengthen that. We need to go back to our communities. I can almost guarantee you every single one of us serve a constituent who has suffered with this, who has worked through this. But also remind yourself that this work is designed for the next 7 generations. You don't know who your next 7 generations are. We are here to protect all of us. We're here to protect all of you and the future generations of Minnesota. So I appreciate you joining in this space with us. I appreciate you deeply listening, and we will have more conversations. Thank you all for your time. Thank you all for the leaders for continuing to show up in this fight with us. And I know that this is hard. And I know that there is a lot of work ahead of us. And we are here as your team, and we are here to do this collectively. Pilame.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank the members of both committees, both parties, for your attentiveness and going over time here. There could not be a more important topic. Thank you so much to Vice Chair Keeler, and then especially to those who shared their experiences with us. With that, this joint meeting is adjourned.